Hello, everybody. Welcome back to This Weird House. As always, I am Nick Boddick, and today we are here with a fellow competitor in the Books of Horror 2024 Books of Horror Indie Brawl. I'm here with Mr. Andrew Nyberg. How are you, sir?
Doing pretty good. How about yourself?
Still waking up like you, man.
Well, you're in Central, so you know I've at least got 3/4 of a pot of coffee advantage on you at this point.
That is true. That is true. Well, I feel like I'm in a perpetual state of always waking up. So, like, yeah, I could be awake for several hours and still be waking up. Just before bed, I'm still waking up.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. No, it's doubly bad here this time though, because yesterday I took the family to Dollywood Splash Country. And
oh, that's awesome.
Oh yeah, it was a blast. I'd actually not been there before. We've been to the main Dollywood several times, but now the only problem is it's a 3-hour drive back. And so ended up staying way later than we wanted to. And by the time we actually had the kids cleaned up and everything like that, it was like 1 a.m. last night. So it was an early morning that I would have preferred to have slept in for, but we all had to get up for various different things this morning. And yeah, it'll be a long day.
Yeah, dude. I driving back 3 hours late at night sounds like I can be the most awake I've ever been. And if I get into a car and start driving on the freeway, it puts me out. I'm like a toddler or I'm like a newborn baby. Like, you take me for a ride in a car and I'm out like a light. So, and I also I don't like other people driving me around. I've been in several car accidents in my life and it's always other people driving. So I haven't been a passenger in a car literally for probably 10 years. And so I do it to myself. Like, my fiance could drive us somewhere, but I'm like, no, I don't trust you to keep me alive. So, I'm sorry, Kimmy, you're a great driver.
There's lots of follow-up questions to that.
Yeah, dude, I've had a ridiculous life, but this isn't about me. This episode is not about me. We are here to talk about Andrew Nyberg, and I just have I want to learn more about you. I have to say, I am a notoriously slow reader. I have Golly Talk on my TBR. I have not read it yet. I do apologize.
I kind of call myself like a moderate speed reader, but you know, I mean, the thing is there's so much stuff to read. Mm-hmm. I have a whole bunch of books to read for work. So I always have this stack that it's like, okay, this is what I get to get through before the next teaching semester. That's always on a deadline. Then there's all of the arcs that people send you. Some of them I've done to myself. Mm-hmm. I've asked people for them. Other times it's been somebody like, hey, can you check this out? And so there's that stack. Then there's the Books of Horror stack. That's like a combination of I want to read and semi-professional obligation where I feel like I need to, because I want to know what other folk are writing. And then there's still also the other optional TBR, the one that's like the books that people have been telling me about that I'm like, oh, this needs to go on there too. So I love when people have read one or more of the books, but at the same time, I mean, one of the reasons that I love doing this is because there are so many amazing books out there. It's how we keep excited about it. Like, if you ever look at, reviews of books, I mean, that's why there's that weird range of 5-star to 1-star where some people are like, oh my God, this is the greatest thing ever. And some people are like, this is the worst thing I've ever read. And, the thing is, I mean, sure, some of them might be trolls or something like that, but for the most part, I mean, just different books speak to different people. So, I mean, yeah, it's fabulous that there's just so much to read.
Yeah, no, I agree. I ever since joining Books of Horror, my TBR has gone from this to book stacked to the ceiling.
That group has been terrible for my my book budget. It's really been pretty rough.
Yeah, that's. I also just want to point out, I have 5 cats, and it's usually when I start to record something, that's when they want to, be loud. Yeah, because
your attention's on the camera and not them. And exactly. So they have to interpose between you and the camera.
Yes, that is exactly it. So if you hear cats, if you see cats, apologies. But yeah, dude, having so much, and I feel like, I feel like we've been in I don't want to say like a golden age, because I feel like everybody has their own definition of it, but we have been in it's such a great time for horror. in particular, I think there's just so many great voices out there right now. And books of horror, like you said, has been terrible for the book budget, been terrible for the wallet, but it's been amazing finding all these new authors I probably otherwise wouldn't have heard of, because it seems like in the bigger horror forums, they always talk about the same handful of authors, which is fine. Like that handful of authors, it puts out amazing stuff, but there's been so many books I've read that are from authors who do not have that like mainstream, I don't want to say appeal. They definitely have mainstream appeal, but just that recognition yet. And I don't know. I love it. I love reading stories from authors because I'm one of them. Like, I'm an author who no one has heard of. And I've been having people read daughter's drawings now, thanks to Books of Horror and The Brawl and everything. And it's been so cool getting, like, speaking of one-star reviews, I don't remember if I mentioned this on the podcast yet, but my favorite one-star review was from someone who said, "Some people shouldn't be writing." That was all the review said. One star, some people, but they spelled the word writing wrong. They wrote it with two T's. Well, my favorite review.
Maybe they were trying not to be hypocritical, so they stopped when they realized they couldn't write a review.
Right? Like, I'm going to choose to believe that that's what that was. Like, guys, just the irony here is just baffling. And then also my favorite five-star review is, "This book is kind of like a beach read, except read next to pond scum." I agree. That's a good way of putting it. This is a dirty, dirty, filthy book.
You need a special edition with that on the cover as the pull quote at the top, because that's pretty perfect.
Right. It's such a good one. Like, if you marketed books to different, like, fans of different subgenres, because I feel like no horror book really falls into one. Like, it's only psychological horror. There's going to be other elements of stuff. I feel like if I were to advertise it or promote it to, like, an extreme horror group or, like, a, you know, something like that, that would be a perfect one. It's actually not a bad idea. Like, advertising a single book in different ways to different, like, subgenre groups. Huh. I'm going to have to think about that. Sorry, brainstorming here. But, Andrew, I wanted to ask, what was your introduction to horror? Like, what got you into the genre?
So that goes back a long, long, long way. When I was about four, my parents let me watch Alien, and I'd already watched a couple other kind of B schlocky horrors. The first one I remember actually was we had a VHS that had both The Blob from 1955, followed by Them, followed by It the Terror from Beyond Space. And oh, nice. I used to watch that all the way through over and over. And I actually have really, really vivid memories of the nightmares I got from Alien at F4. But, you know, the thing is, you know, I watched that several times, when I was really, really little. And then Aliens came out. And, I actually really love that pairing of films because, Alien really leaves it on such on a fairly dark note. You have the, Ripley as the surviving final girl, et cetera. But for the most part, it's a dark, dreary movie. There's no real uplift at the end, even though the alien's been defeated. But then you come with Aliens, the James Cameron taking over and, taking the bleak horror and moving much more towards sort of the summer blockbuster action, sci-fi action film. And, it's interesting to see the relationship between the fear and dread and then the catharsis that comes from the much more upbeat and fast-paced tone of the second. And so for me as a kid, that was incredibly valuable. And thinking about how fears resolve, I actually was, even when pretty young, I was fairly aware of the fact that I found Alien much less frightening of an experience because of the completion that comes from seeing the much more effective victory in Aliens. So, yeah. That's really the foundation of it, though, was thinking about, because I had a lot of reasons to be afraid as a kid. I grew up in a pretty loud and contentious household. you know, I also saw, you know, a good number of bad things happen kind of around me growing up and stuff like that. And so, you know, I personally was fortunate and for the most, you know, that I kind of escaped a lot of it. But, you know, I saw a lot of dark things out there. And so it was, yeah, it was really, you know, helpful to have something that let me think about how horror lets us process these dark events around us. And so, you know, when we read about something like, you know, trauma or violence in a horror novel, it really helps equip us, I think, for understanding how that is part of the world that we live in as well. And so, yeah, from there, I moved on. I watched tons of horror growing up. I like to say I was raised on horror. Me and my mom especially have watched just an absolute shitload of horror movies together. You know, I mean, I had childhood favorites of like The Thing was a big favorite in our household. It still is, actually. We watch it all the time. I liked the slasher movies. I was a big Halloween, Jason and Freddy fan. You know, I was born in 79, so I got to see the full glory of the 80s horror scene with all the really schlocky creatures and the classic slashers. And I really just kind of continued on from there. I discovered King in about fifth grade, I think, because my older sister was reading his books. And because I looked up to her growing up, I always wanted to read and watch the things that she was. And so, you know, I ended up reading Pet Sematary far too young, It in the Stand far too young. And here we are now.
For sure. So you got into reading King, and then when did you decide that you wanted to try your hand at doing what, doing what the people you were reading do?
So, I actually, you know, it's funny because I started writing horror short stories when I was in like seventh grade. I had a really supportive English teacher who would, you know, on his own time would just read short stories I handed him. And so I actually had this like really this stretch where I was writing a whole bunch of short stories, just passing them off for feedback. And then weirdly, though, from there, I took an extremely long break from writing horror. You know, moving on from there, I got really interested in fantasy in my teens. I had that stretch when I was like 17, 18, and 19, where I threatened to write like an epic fantasy novel and failed. I never really got past the planning stages on those. Like, I liked drawing the maps, making up places and backstory and stuff. And, I really didn't understand how to put together a plot at that point. When I got to college, I actually started out as a computer science major. I was kind of thinking maybe I can learn how to write video games, but then I actually realized I hated coding. I couldn't stand sitting at the computer labs at the university, and switched over to English with a more of a focus actually on poetry and kind of absurdism and fiction, and wrote science fiction for a while and kind of dead end. Well, so I almost finished a science fiction novel when I was like 22 or something like that. And then I was about three quarters of the way done with it. And a book came out of the exact same premise. And it just kind of killed my idea on it because I felt like I was like, well, shit, this has been done now. And, in science fiction, a lot does or can rest on your premise, because honestly, I was in my 20s, early 20s, and I really didn't understand character as well either. You know, it's one of those things, like, I will say, looking back, so many of the things that shaped me as a writer was really breakthroughs about understanding things like the fundamentals of plot, how one builds a character with a drive, rather than just relying on ideas and premises. Now, I ended up finishing two master's degrees in English, both of which were focused on poetry. I wrote poetry all the way through about 2019. And I had written my first horror novel by that point, but I actually didn't start actually writing horror till about 2017. So yeah, I had about 17 years trying other genres and other things, and I have three abandoned novels, three completed novels that are sitting on shelves that are probably never going anywhere. Then I wrote, what later became the Mobius store, starting in about 2017 to 2019.
Okay. Yeah. Poetry is something that try as I might, I just can't. I enjoy reading it. I just got this Thomas Ligotti book that has a lot of poetry in it. Yeah, but as a writer, it seems like an entirely different beast to me. I don't understand what makes poetry. Like, I don't get, and it sounds like a joke, but I actually do mean it. Like, I don't, because, you know, growing up, I assume poetry meant, okay, it's like short stanzas, short lines, and then they rhyme at the end. And as I've grown up, I've learned, oh, okay, it doesn't have to be short. It doesn't have to rhyme. So, like, I don't get, like, the qualifications of what makes poetry rather than a short story, almost. Like, I see the difference between the two. I just don't get the fundamentals of poetry. And it's, like, it's fascinating because what poetry I have read, which admittedly isn't a ton, it's, like, the Ligotti book I'll use again, for example, Pictures of Apocalypse. He is telling a story in his poetry, but like the rest of his work, I don't get what it's, how it, I'm sounding like a dumbass explaining this. Like, I don't get what makes poetry poetry, I guess. Like, if I might stray from the script I kind of have, what makes poetry poetry? Like, what is it? How, oh my God, I sound like an idiot. Do you get what I'm saying? I'm
rambling. Oh yeah, absolutely. Like, so no, it's actually, you know, it's a really difficult question. You know, I teach creative writing. And so this is a question that comes up in a lot of conversations, especially on the intro level. You know, we're doing intro to creative writing is one of my main classes. And we do a poetry unit, a fiction unit, and then either nonfiction or drama and screenplay. And, yeah, it's a conversation we have a lot because, you know, a lot of anthologies will do things like include what people call prose poems and stuff like that. And it's like, well, where the hell is the actual line here? Right. And so, you know, there are some, like, there's no hard line between the two, that, 'cause that's the tricky part is, there's no one thing that's like you point to it and like, that's a poem, that's fiction, or that's prose. Instead, it's kind of a combination of traits, and poetry tends to lean towards one concentration of various. It's kind of like picking off of a checklist. It's like there's like five things on this list, five things on this. Poetry will have slightly more from this list than this list, and vice versa. But, you know, some of the common features that we'd look for, first off, there is an extent to which if somebody calls it a poem, like if an author calls it a poem and says, this is my poem, I mean, you kind of have to start treating it as a poem. If somebody says, this is a short story or this is a piece of fiction, you kind of have to start treating it from that lens. You look at it from that angle. So that's going to be the first thing, is there's sort of a declaration of intent and placing ourselves, I think, within genres and types. But that being said, you know, poetry's most frequent defining features are going to be line breaks. And it doesn't matter where the line breaks occur, but basically the idea is you're not just hitting enter with line breaks. Instead, the line breaks do need to play some sort of role in shaping the meaning of the poem. So, you know, maybe they are inserted in a line to create a moment of suspense where you complete a thought. You know, maybe they're forcing a specific word to dangle at the end of the line to call attention to that word and make it more meaningful. But one way or another, that's probably the most frequent defining trait is the use of those line breaks. Second, there tends to be a much greater attention to sound and voice in poetry. So it's not necessarily, you know, we're not necessarily thinking rhythm and rhyme, though that can certainly be part of it. But you're more likely to see things like dense alliteration and consonants and internal rhyme and assonance and that kind of thing in a poem as a more defined feature. And then again, also, in theory, it should be used to create some sort of notable effect that's part of the experience of the piece. other than that, you tend to have a difference in the nature of plot in poetry. Of course, you know, poetry has to have a plot. It's just what constitutes a plot is not necessarily going to be the same thing. And ultimately, a poem, a poem's plot is going to be some sort of clearly defined change of state between beginning and end. So, you know, it might be a character undergoes a transformation, and that's where you get a more traditional kind of character-driven poem. Sometimes you'll see a change of ideas where you're focused on a different idea from the beginning and there's a clear contrast drawn by the parts of the poem. Other times there will be, you know, you can have a narrative poem that tells traditional stories. I have a decent number of my own poems that are just straight up narratives, but they do use controlled devices like line breaks and assonance to help accent that story in unique ways. And then you also tend to have a greater concentration of figurative language in poetry as well. So, you know, you're more likely to have, you know, considerable presence of metaphors, extended metaphors. You know, allegory is pretty common. You'll have similes, personification as major ongoing features. And then, you know, of course, you are more likely to see sort of a density of language as well. They call it poetic compression. You know, that's, you know, and basically one of, like, I know one thing that I do that I actually straddles both my poetry and my prose is I tend to drop a lot of words out of language. And so I write in a lot of fragments and concise phrases because I am trying to compress things down. Gala Talk has that as a particular feature of its voice. Varka in a lot of places has a kind of a clipped way of thinking where all his thoughts are kind of compacted and compressed. And there's a world justification for that, but it's also part of the intended musicality of the language. So yeah, you know, and there's a couple other things we could talk about, but basically the idea is that if you have a significant number of those things present, it doesn't matter anymore which ones are present. It's just that you have that concentration that helps us talk about how this is acting as a poem versus how this is acting as a piece of prose.
Thank you for that. That is literally the best explanation I've ever gotten on it. I've tried like looking it up and all I get is like very Merriam-Webster definitions. That was a big help. Genuinely. Thank you, Andrew. I appreciate that.
No problem.
I'm glad we took that little, tangent. Yes. We go on a lot of tangents on this show. So
nothing wrong with that.
That was the most informative one yet, I'll tell you. So as you've developed as a writer, be it in sci-fi, horror, poetry, who have been your biggest influences and like, what is it about their work that has connected with you or that you've connected with?
So the biggest influence actually is a poet. He's passed on. His name's Dr. Arthur Smith. He was my professor for, I think, 9 different classes, and he was the chair of my thesis committee. Part of it is that we just, you know, we connected as people as well as, like, you know, students and teachers, and he became a long-term friend of mine until his passing. One of the things that drew me to wanting to be a writer and studying English, you know, for so long in school is that I kind of think of English as the omni major, where if it's written in the English language, you can actually pull it underneath that umbrella. And I like reading about a lot of different things. Like, I actually have a really longstanding interest in medicine. I read the American Journal of Medicine sometimes, the New England Journal as well. I read a lot of astronomy stuff. I read a lot of technology stuff as well. I'm interested in computers and robotics, and I've done some of that stuff growing up as well. I read a lot of history too. So, you know, I have a lot of sort of very disparate interests. And, you know, one thing that Dr. Smith did that was really interesting is both in his teaching and in his work is he pulls from all sorts of directions into his material. So, you know, he would have a poem that include, you know, some really offbeat elements of religion in it. Then it would move us over to mythology. Then it'd start talking about the speed of light. And, you know, you start building connections between these really widely varied ideas. And, you know, I was very interested in that process. And so, that's something that transfers into a lot of my work. All of my pieces have some pretty disparate elements pulled together. So, you know, Gala Talk, of course, it draws really heavily from from pre-fall of communism, Yugoslavia. My family's from there. And so I had a pretty vested interest in building on my family history. In fact, actually, the Gali Otok prison, which is the foundation for the prison in Galatok, my grandfather was sentenced there for 3 years for smuggling. Oh, wow. And of course, smugglers are a big part of the Galatok plot as well. But then also, you know, it's a post-nuclear story. So, you know, I had some historical elements, but then I also started pulling from a lot of things from various different forms of science fiction and post-apocalyptic horror. There's also some biology underlying it as well, and some kind of I've always been interested in exobiology, and that plays a part in the story as well. And so, you know, again, Galatok pulls from a lot of these different directions. I have an upcoming novel called Extinction Dream, which comes out May 2025 through Wicked House Publishing. And that one's good. That one pulls a lot from my science and astronomy reading. There's a lot of things about, you know, sort of looking at the logistics of moving across our solar system. And, you know, a lot of my work sort of tackles things like multidimensional theory and that kind of stuff. So, but yeah. So, yeah, you know, and that was something I really do attribute to having learned very heavily from Dr. Smith. Next, in terms of biggest influences, Franz Kafka is a huge one for me. The Trial is probably my favorite book of all time. I read it more or less every year, and I have for about 20 years. I will say I actually owe that one to Alan Weyer, a fiction professor I had. I wrote some weird-ass shit for him. And he was this really, really straight-laced, southern-lit guy, and I was turning in these bizarro, absurdist pieces, you know. So, you know, he was trying to put my work in a framework that that worked for him, that made sense for him. And every single thing that I wrote, he kept telling me to read Kafka, and especially The Trial was the one he was the most, he really wanted me to read. And I read it and I thought it was absolutely brilliant. And that one, you know, what I love about that is, you know, from the outside, if you sort of step back and you look at the overarching logic and try to impose an interpretation on that piece, nothing quite holds together. It's very resistant to definitive statements. And it's, you know, part of the themes of the book is that you never quite know what the truth really is. And so, you know, it's an intentional feature. But then internally, though, there's so many connections you can draw across it. Like, you know, I don't know if you've read The Trial, but, you know, the character Joseph K. wakes up one fine Sunday morning to find himself placed under arrest. And you know, there's these two investigating officers who are arresting him. They don't know anything about why he's been arrested, just that their instructions are to arrest him, wait there with him until the examining magistrate arrives. And then that guy is just there to take down some basic information, and he knows nothing else. And everybody he encounters is perfectly happy to help him out as best they can, but none of them can offer him anything useful. They only know the exact sphere that they're meant to operate in. They only know the exact task they're meant to. And so, I mean, people give him these lengthy monologues about how things work and from their point of view, but none of it ever gives him any answers. And so I love that. So like there's this internal richness to the logic of the story, but there's an external opaqueness. And, you know, you see things like that crop into a lot of modern stuff, especially something like Jeff Vandermeer's Annihilation, which of course, I mean, is definitely a huge influence on me. It is one of my favorite books, and it was pretty, you know, there's a lot of homages to Annihilation in Galatok. I had some direct influence there as well. And then finally, The last one I would actually name is a Japanese author named Haruki Murakami. Probably my favorite author of all time. I actually am sitting right next to a shelf of his collected work in multiple languages.
That's awesome.
And, he's actually, I have a specialty in Japanese lit at this point, specifically the post-World War II Japanese novel. And it was a private project that started in about 2005 or so when I first started reading Murakami. And then a friend of mine gave me one of his books and I really loved it. And so I was like, okay, so let's read some more by this guy. And so I read like four or five of his books. And then I started reading about him and his influences. And so I started reading the books that influenced him. And then I started reading the books that were saying they were influenced by him. And it kind of spiraled out of control. And I have you know, multiple shelves back there of Japanese novels now, and I've started teaching a series of classes based on them, including a really fun class I piloted last fall on Japanese horror. That was a really great class. It was one of the most fun classes I've gotten to teach. But yeah, so Murakami would definitely be the third person I'd name as sort of core influences.
That's awesome. I love foreign horror, and I'm a little bit into I love Murakami. I haven't read a ton by Murakami, but what I have read, I have very much enjoyed. I found a lot of good horror in Indonesia, mostly in the form of short stories. I'm sure there's a million novels out there that I'm not privy to yet, but Indonesia in particular is, I did for a different project I'm working on, I spoke to, the author Nadia Balkan. I'm not sure if you're familiar. And she is from Indonesia, and she explained to me how their entire culture is kind of steeped in horror, and I don't mean to say that in like a, I don't know, just like they have, it's kind of interwoven into their upbringing almost, and these different stories they have and legends and folklore, mythology, whatever you want to call it, and how it's kind of woven into their everyday experience, and how they just, how that whole culture operates is just, there's this thread of horror, and how all these different mythologies are kind of analogous to actual things that they will encounter and things that they, you know, just everyday life. And it's fascinating.
That lines really closely too with, the Japanese view of horror as well. Japan has what I think it's 6 million kami, the minor deities that, are part of absolutely everything. And, the spiritual worldview they have, really places everyday life side by side with the supernatural in a way you just don't get here in the West.
Exactly.
And, on the one hand, it's from that Western, I'm an academic, and I'm not going to lie, I'm skeptical as fuck. My wife is really big into supernatural and stuff like that. She definitely believes in ghosts and this kind of stuff. And, I have a really hard line on it where, if I can't mesh it with my understanding of science, then, I'm almost certain to reject it. And so, I have my own views of what a ghost would be and that kind of stuff. But, at the same time, I'm definitely not somebody who really sees a whole lot of supernatural, right around the corner. But at the same time, I absolutely love the very magical way traditional Japanese outlook sees the world, where, everything is imbued with spiritualism and magic and stuff like that. And I think it's a really amazing way to look at the world. I've always found that really interesting about it. And I can, it sounds like Indonesian folklore sort of has a very similar feel to it.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm with you. I would love to believe in the supernatural. And that goes to a whole different thing. I have such like a deep-rooted existential fear of what's going to happen when I die. And like, to the point that like, I see a therapist about it. Like it keeps me up at night. Like it's a genuine like concern I have, and that I know I can't do anything about, but I would love to learn that there's something after, besides, it's the concept of infinite nothing that really is what gets under my skin.
One of my favorite thoughts for that actually is, and I always draw a blank on his name because, that professor I was telling you about, Dr. Arthur Smith, my favorite book by him is called The Fortunate Era. The phrase The Fortunate Era was coined by a Nobel Prize winning physicist. And I always blank on the guy's name, but, he basically had, a theory, that we live in what he called the Fortunate Era, which is the period in which matter can exist. Otherwise, outside the Fortunate Era, all that would exist is energy. So, what I like about that thought is that in theory, our existence is, essentially speaking, some sort of electrical signal. It's like a pattern of electricity in our brain, or, perhaps we want to start, get into the idea of the soul where, we're some sort of other form of energy. But it would stand to reason that if we are a specific pattern and everything is energy, then we would exist everywhere within that, because that pattern would be present in that energy. So, you know, eventually if the universe returns to energy, then also so would we as well, to be actually in whatever that is. So, you know, it's the most scientific defense I've actually had for the idea, or I found for the idea of some sort of afterlife, is that we would resume existing when everything returned to energy, but as a non-corporeal being, because matter can't exist during that period.
That's super interesting.
And it's actually grounded in real scientific theory. So, you know, it's you know, I definitely should understand that existential, you know, concern about, you know, nothingness versus, you know, what might just be, you know, a pipe dream, you yeah, know, right. And, you know, you don't want to sell yourself on the pipe dream. And, you know, when you're if you feel like the alternative might actually legit be the case.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, that's interesting. I've never really looked at it from a purely scientific viewpoint. That's something I'll have to look into. The Fortunate Era by, you said by Dr. Smith, is that something that I could find somewhere?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's pretty easy to come across. You know, okay. I mean, he wasn't like a bestseller, you know, in everybody's household, but he did pretty well with his books, especially in the world of poetry. Okay. Yeah, it's Dr. Arthur Smith, The Fortunate Era. You know, I'll say the downside of the scientific view is that it also makes some pretty bleak thoughts about what ghosts would be like. You know how some folk will say things like, you know, well, if something bad happens in a place, it leaves a mark, you know, and yeah. So there's always that thought that, you know, a location can be haunted. But the problem I have with that is that, we're hurtling through space at like 600,000 miles per hour. We will never inhabit the same space that we were in before ever in our existence. You know, we are constantly in a different coordinate of the universe. And so, you know, if let's say that, you know, there is some sort of weird spiritual trace left at the place where something happened. Well, I mean, that's just hundreds of millions of miles away from us at this point. You know, massacre in 1880. Yeah, that's somewhere way past the edge of the solar system at this point. You know, we've moved on from there. And so, like, I actually have this image, and I actually have a poem about it that appeared in North American Review, of, you know, Earth hurtling through space, just leaving this line of ghosts and souls through the cosmos as we go.
That sounds awesome. yeah, no, that's an interesting way to look at it, I guess. Yeah, because thinking about it like that, bad things leaving a mark, yeah, you only think of like the physical, what you can touch in front of you right now. But yeah, strictly speaking, we're in a different spot now than we were when we started the interview.
Yep. So
that's weird to think about. Man, science is crazy, dude. Space is crazy.
I mean, but that's what's so fun about it. I mean, everything like is so fucked up. And, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, just the fact that, you know, it doesn't like, you know, that our solar system isn't just like planets smashing off of each other like some wacky ass multi-ball and pinball, right. You know, is pretty amazing.
Like the marbles at the end of Men in Black.
Yeah, exactly.
So you mentioned, excuse me, man, I'm getting something. The world that Galatak is not the world it inhabits, but the world you've built for Galatak is a post-nuclear. Is it sort of like an alternate history type thing? Or let me ask the question I wanted to ask. In crafting this sort of post-apocalyptic world, you know, post-nuclear world, I should say. How did you differentiate from other entries in that genre, like the post just world ending disaster genre?
So a couple of things about it. One, actually, and this is the biggest, is that, you know, like I call it post-nuclear, but I don't like to call the book post-apocalyptic, because it's really more what I would call post-reconstruction. Okay. So in the world of Galatak, the nuclear war in question took place 40 years before the story. So there's been a long history after the main incident that sort of sets up the world for what it's going to be. And so, you know, at this point, civilization, at least in the ordered civilization sense, has been reestablished. You know, you don't have chaos and anarchy. You do have a semi-authoritarian government that has reimposed itself on Eastern Europe, which honestly, I don't think would be that big a stretch if there was some sort of major global catastrophe of that sort. Right. You know, I think that's pretty much, I think you'd see that most people, unfortunately, would want to trade some of their freedom for security and stability. Yeah. You know, and historically, that's just been the case, where if you're faced with the choice of likely starvation or having to toil under a more authoritarian rule, people have often sort of opted for the latter because they would rather live another day to hope things improve than to starve to death. And so that is a part of it, though, is that I really wanted it to be a functioning world. I didn't want it to be like, you know, Walking Dead survivors, you know, poking through the ruins for cans. You know, I do have a more immediate post-apocalyptic story I'm writing right now, but that one also has its own, sort of angle on it as well. But no, so that's kind of step one. Step two is that, you know, one of the things I think does set it apart is the Eastern European setting. You know, there have been a couple of books that have sort of featured, that sort of, Yugoslavian, a Slavic bloc. There have been a couple that have actually featured Gali Otok, but, it isn't really that Western a story. You know, people don't talk about the Gali Otok prison, even though, you know, horrible atrocities have happened there. You know, it's kind of outside our vernacular. And so, you know, a couple of the things that helped with that, though, is, you know, I was able to bring that in. So there's a unique history, I think, that a lot of people won't know about in reading it. And it's one that I'm eager to share with people because it's also my family history. But then also part of the inspiration for it is that, you know, my family's Slavic. And so, I mean, they actually have, you know, a lot of the Slavic mentality, which is a very workmanlike survivor mentality. I mean, you know, they lived through some of the hardest times of late stage communism. And so, you know, like my uncle-in-law smuggled himself out of Yugoslavia in a crate on a boxcar. Wow. You know, he almost starved to death in the box, and he was like literally pissing and shitting himself, you know, en route. Wow. Actually there's a character in the book named Brogdon who's very heavily influenced by my uncle-in-law. That was part of the inspiration for it, was the wild ass stories he told me. He had a very, English wasn't his first language, and so he had a very particular cadence for speaking. And part of where the story came from was this sort of conversation between the character of Brogdon and the main character of Varka. And I really wanted it to have that sort of clipped Eastern European immigrant feel. However, as part of that, when you write a story set in a different culture, you also can't just have people talking the way they do in translation. So I also, part of the development was to work with the idea of linguistic drift, where the central governmental organization had imposed a new language standard. A couple of the characters speak it, and they're the ones who sound much more fluent in sort of modern language. So Varka has he's got a little bit of an accent because there's regional accents in that world, but his is much more straightforward, much more modern. And two of the characters he spends most of the book interacting with, they have what would sound like traditional Slavic languages in speaking in translation, but that's because they are speaking a dialect, or their natural dialect is not the one that is the dialect of the story. And so they literally are speaking in translation during it. So there was a weird, like, I wanted to capture a voice because it was part of the inspiration of the piece, but I also had to build the world to justify the voice. So that's another major element, though. And then, you know, I mean, there's some things, you know, there's some things that are sort of part of the subgenre choices I made. There is some scientific ideas underlying it that I think set it apart, but I won't get into that because that's kind of major plot spoilers. But then also, island setting, I think, also helps create its own feel that the place itself is, it's sort of it's isolated in a way that's almost like it's removed from time. The place, has at the time of the story has more than 100 years of history behind it. It's very, fallen apart, very, very degraded. And, basically it itself is actually kind of removed from its post-apocalyptic setting. It's like they move from this broken world that's getting back on its feet, this even more broken world that comes from a place when the world was supposedly intact. And so, that's another element that I think that helps set it apart as well, though.
That's super interesting. Yeah, I'm gonna have to. That sounds like stuff that is right up my alley. I might have to bump it up my TBR. I'm not just saying that either. Like, I've read the description of it. I'm familiar with it, and yeah, I think I want to read that soon. That sounds so awesome. What are some of your influences outside of literature that you draw from when you're writing? Whether it's horror, anything you write, like film. Artists, music, things like that.
So, a couple of the most immediate actually are our family. So first off, like I mentioned for Galatalk, my extended family did play a pretty big role. In fact, actually, you'll see there's actually like a Croatian imprint on a lot of my work. So like Mobius Store, one of the main villains of the piece is named Veles, who is a trickster deity from Croatia. He's very analogous to Loki. He even has a brother named Perun, who's very much like Thor. I draw things like that. And the forthcoming novel I have, there's a subplot that's set in a national park in Croatia where there's some pretty lovely waterfalls. So that family history has had some influence. Also, my relationship with my sister growing up. Shows up in a lot of different ways in my work, especially in the Mobius Store, and then also in some of my short fiction, as well as a novel I'm working on right now. I moved around a lot as well when I was growing up. So, I was born in Canada. I moved to Texas when I was still an infant. I moved to New Hampshire, to Texas, to New Hampshire, to Tennessee, to Texas, to Tennessee. So I've kind of ping-ponged across the country, and I've gotten to see a lot of sort of different cultures across the states, and I've done a lot of travel as well internationally. And so, clash of culture is definitely something that shows up in a lot of my work, where very differing perspectives tend to be at the core of a lot of my conflicts. But then beyond that, I love music. I grew up during the sort of the peak of 90s grunge and industrial and stuff like that. So, draw a lot of my atmosphere and vibe from the songs I loved growing up. And like right next to me, it's not assembled right now because I'm in the process of moving some stuff about. But I play the drums. I boxed for a while and did taekwondo, and I do taekwondo with my kids now. I have terrible ADHD, and so bouncing back and forth between activities, I think, is a really important part of my process. I don't know whether I could say that, like playing the drums directly feeds into my writing, but one thing I do is I'll compose, I'll be drafting, and then I'll go over to the drums and play for a while, and then I'll come back to my computer and write some more, and then I'll go. I will go to the garage and hit the punching bag for a while, and then I'll come back to the computer. And like moving back and forth between these things is just really intrinsic to what I do. I think though, if I had to pick any one activity or hobby I have that influences my writing, I'd probably say I do a lot of artwork. Especially pen and ink stuff. Like I don't have any of that right here. I have a painting behind me that I use as my main backdrop. But I do a lot of pen and ink work. And one thing that but I don't do sketch work first. I literally just sit down with the blank page. I take the pen and I just start drawing what I'm going to try to draw. And you know, you can't really make mistakes that way. Or if they do, if they're minor, you can oftentimes sort of work them into the drawing and fix it and adapt. Mm-hmm. But anything big and the whole thing's destroyed. And, you know, I do a lot of very fine line work. And so there's an element of kind of concentration and control that I learned from practicing this that I really try to bring into my writing. I want there to be a high level of intentionality in what I do. You know, I do have I have had a lot of people tell me about sort of the voice and the composition of my pieces. And that I think, you know, sort of just being meticulous with pen and ink work has transferred into a lot of the other things I do as well. But I mean, you know, other than that, I mean, I play video games. I do play a lot of board games. I'm actually working with John Cohn right now to design a board game and got to help him a little bit with the writing of the Thanksgiving board game.
That's on my bucket list.
Oh yeah. No, I mean, same here. I grew up, playing, you know, like I said, my relationship with my sister plays a huge role in my stuff. And we played so many board games growing up. That was like our biggest activity together. Yeah. And I mean, I used to make board games on cardboard boxes. I'd draw the map of it. You know, I mean, they'd be silly and simple, but yeah, I mean, it's literally always been a dream of mine to be able to make a game. And so, you know, I've already, and I just got my first writing credit for a game. And then, you know, working on designing one has been absolute bucket list item being checked off. But I mean, I think all of these things kind of tie in together to be a part of just how I make things. You know, it's like board games, for example, they work on, you know, they create contained worlds on the board that operate within closed systems of rules. And within those systems, they make sense. If you step out, I mean, the idea of a board game is this really irrational thing. You know, I mean, it doesn't in any way resemble life or anything we know. It's like, you know, you literally built this very contained sandbox where a limited number of actions can function. And, you know, I think in a certain way, you know, thinking of writing and, you know, according to similar underlying principles is a really foundational way, element of the way in which we make sense of the stories that we tell. You know, X character, you know, always gets angry when X happens. And so, you know, either this is going to happen during the story or it'll happen and they'll refuse to get angry. And that's character growth. You know, that's how we understand the way the elements of our piece function is. We create rules and we see how either those rules play out or they get broken or violated. You know, that's always one of those kind of messy questions because, I mean, what are we not influenced by in our day-to-day lives? You know, I mean, if we're paying attention to it, it's becoming a part of who we are and how we see things.
I would definitely agree with that. That was a good answer, dude. That was a solid answer. No, that's definitely true. I mean, of course, I have the things that I pull from, you know, movies, video games, TV, whatever. But yeah, like if I think about it, and the only full length novel I've written is Daughter's Drawings, but for that one, I could probably point to any page and be like, oh, okay, this isn't influenced by another piece of media. This was that day I had at the beach with, you know, my fiance, or like, you know, this argument I had with my mom when I was 15 is feeding into this character interaction. Like that kind of thing.
Isn't it funny how that stuff happens? Like, so I'm writing a novel right now. It's and one of its main storylines is these two little girls. One's 12 and one's 8, and they're locked in a bunker underneath their parents' house. And you know, at one point, one of them gets sick, and the other one tells this story about a birthday she had where her mother made her crepe Suzette's and, you know, like the kind filled with jelly. And she just happened to come down with the flu that night. And so she ended up spending the night throwing up streams of purple jelly. And that actually literally happened to me. You know, it was one of those things where I didn't expect it to be part of the story. This wasn't planned or anything like that, but I started writing the sequence about this older sister trying to console her sick younger sister. And so she's like, okay, so remember that time when this happened? And, you know, out came this weird little childhood anecdote of, it was actually like, I couldn't eat jelly for like 20 years after that. It would immediately make me nauseated. And, you know, I mean, I never would have expected that to end up in something I was working on. But yeah, it was just this random inclusion. There's a whole bunch of little memories like that that just crop up when you're writing, you know, relationships between parents and children or between siblings or friends. I mean, yeah, we freely pull from all kinds of stuff. And yeah, it's so much fun in a lot of ways because, you know, everything we write, yeah. We're kind of reliving so many different things that we've been through, no matter how wild or out there our premises might be.
Yeah, for sure. Like there's definitely an element of living vicariously through a character. Cause like I've, you know, hopefully it's not the antagonist of a story, but like I don't mean to keep bringing up Daughter's Drawings, but in that, like there's one instance I can think of where, you know, that feeling when you like get into an argument with someone and they say something and then you think of the perfect comeback, like an hour later when you're driving and you're just like, damn it, I should have said that, but you didn't. And now you live with knowing that you had this comeback somewhere within you. I got that comeback out in the book. So like, nice. Yeah, I definitely get like where, how everything feeds into it. And yeah, it's very fascinating too, because like in writing, it's, I don't want to say like uncovered anything, you know, really substantial, but things that I doubt I would have ever thought about again. Like interactions I had with friends in sixth grade have come back to me because I've been writing the story and something within that story just kind of triggered that specific memory. And I'm like, holy crap, I remember that thing that happened with Joe and Bob. Like, and it's very interesting how writing kind of unlocks these certain things. If you know, put in the right cheat code, so to speak, the right combination of words gets you to that memory.
Well, and I think to some extent too, that's how, I think that's how we create a lot of our own unique voices, you know. We don't necessarily move, when people talk about writing process and things like that, you know, I think a lot of people sort of look at the concept of thinking of a story in linear terms, especially when they're outside of the writing. So, but, you know, I mean, you mentioned, you know, we mentioned earlier how, you know, you go off on tangents, right? You know, during these podcasts. And yeah, I mean, you know, I think I always say a lot of the best stuff comes out during tangents. And that's because we are moving away from the obvious linear thinking. And instead, we're following associative pathways. And associative pathways by nature to us, I think, are actually inherently more meaningful than linear logical pathways. And the reason why is because that's part of how our memories function. You know, they have sort of they still only have a limited understanding of the way in which our brains actually function. But, you know, they have a pretty sound understanding of the way associative storage works, that, you know, we create links between ideas. We retain the ideas that we are able to make more links to. So, you know, if you're studying something, if you're learning a new subject and you're able to connect it to something in your own history or something that you already understand, you're much more likely to retain that information because it feels more important and more meaningful. Oh, because yeah. Now we have an association with it. Now we've put it in an emotional and personal context that we can understand. And so we want to write a piece that also has a sense of meaning and resonance. If we're pulling purely from clinical storytelling, you know, logical, this happens, therefore this happens, this, therefore this happens, you know, I mean, sure, you're going to probably tell a pretty solid story. It's going to be well-paced. You know, it'll make sense and be coherent, but it's probably also not going to connect with people in the same way because we're not connected to it in the way that we need to be. You know, I think that's part of the reason why we're drawn to flawed characters who make poor decisions, who make mistakes as well, because again, that logical pathway is the obvious path. You know, that's the funny thing is, I mean, we do some dumbass shit in our lives. You know, I don't know how I lived this long, actually, with all the dumb shit I did when I was younger. And, but looking back to it, you know, we knew, you know, we understood the smart course of action, the safe and careful course of action. It's not like we didn't get the idea. It's just that
chose to ignore it.
Yeah, exactly. Because we wanted to, you know, we wanted to experiment. We want cause, we want to see what's going to happen. We want to not know. And you know, if a story is too rigid, too logical, eventually it gets to the point where also you just know what's going to happen. It becomes predictable and becomes obvious. And association is the realm of the unexpected. That's why you end up in new places that don't necessarily make rational sense, but they made sense at the time and the way you got there.
Yeah, definitely. So the I have one more question for you. You mentioned that I guess I mentioned and you agreed that writing a board game was on your bucket list. What is one other thing on your writing bucket list? Like, what is one thing in writing that you want to accomplish? And I don't mean in terms of like, I'll get a story published by this venue. I mean, what, so like my, for example, one of my things is, and you mentioned it at the top of this episode, that you want to create a fiction, or I want to create a fictional world, like a living, breathing, mine would be more horror centric, but like a high fantasy type world, but set with, you know, horror. And that is one of my things on my bucket list. What is on your writing bucket list?
Ooh, that's a really tough one. You know, cause, I'm not going to lie. I've actually checked off a decent number of boxes lately. Like just for example, I have a science fiction novel set in orbit, coming out, next year. That was a huge one for me. I really wanted to write a piece of science fiction and, you know, I ended up figuring out a really good angle to tie it to a horror narrative that, I think people will be pretty interested in. I always wanted to write a choose your own adventure novel. And, you know, I've got a, try not to die book coming out, which I'm super stoked about. I can't believe that came up when Mark Tellius reached out. I was just like, oh my God, this is awesome.
That's so cool, man. And it's
been a blast to work on. And ironically, it's also, a fantasy horror. So it's actually set in a world that I built called the Shadowlands. It's the setting of The Neverborn Thief, a young adult dark fantasy novel I had come out in March. I've got a book of poetry out. I should have another one coming soon. I've got a collection of short stories coming out. If there was one thing I would really like to do, I would like to write like an epic trilogy at some point. And I have no idea what that would be. You know, like I've had some folk reach out to me and tell me I should write like a Galatalk sequel, and that may happen. I have an idea for a story, and like, but here's the thing: if I do a Galatalk sequel, it would not be like a direct linear sequel. It wouldn't be like Varka or his. You know, what's the next step for one of these characters? It'd have to be its entirely own piece, partially because of the way Galatalk ends, but also because I don't see those characters having a continued story for me as an author. They don't speak to me anymore in that way. So that, you know, I could have a story that intersects with somebody from the novel of Galatalk, but I wouldn't want to tell that same kind of pathway. You know, nothing I have at this point really has its own, has a larger arc beyond the book that I've written. I'm a huge fan of standalone stories. I actually think, and some of that I think is actually a bit of a rebellion against the contemporary writing climate where, it's actually been one of my favorite things about finding things like books of horror and stuff is, you know, you mentioned earlier that there's so many great books coming out from some of these, you know, I'm the indie people and some of the folk from the big presses. But one thing I've noticed about stuff from the big presses is that it's so emphasized on franchises on licenses and stuff like that. And, you know, like I was a huge fan of the writers Preston and Child when I was younger, you know, Relic, Riptide, Thunderhead, you know, they have some pretty fantastic books, but, you know, you know, I read maybe, I don't know, 8 or 9 by them. And then, you know, one thing I started seeing is, you know, on the cover, it'd say a Pendergast novel or something. And like now when I see that, I immediately just want to not touch that book. You know, if it's a blank novel and it's part of an ongoing franchise, to me, it's starting to feel like a lot of these authors are, you know, I mean, there's obviously the cash grab element where they're just building on name familiarity.
Naturally.
But, you know, what really got to me with the Preston and Child books is I noticed that they stopped developing their characters, that the past books were their development. And at that point, it's like, well, but I bought this book. I want development in this book. You know, I don't want to have to do homework and read 8 books to read the book that I just bought. You know, I really, really worked to create contained narratives that, as much of the story as I want to tell is told within that story. And, you know, and that's one thing I love about the indie horror community, though. It's been the place I've rediscovered standalone novels, and, that's been absolutely delightful.
For sure. No, it's definitely, I agree with you. And like, I love the MCU. I love comic universes. I do like franchises, but I'm with you. Like, especially with reading, I think, or, you know, literature, like it's so much more of a investment in so many different ways. It's more of a time investment. It's going to take you longer to read 9 books than it is 1 to get a full story. Like, I love the Dark Tower series, but I have to be in a very specific kind of mind frame to do that, to read and go on that journey. It's going to take me, like I said, I'm a slow reader. It's going to take me a long time to get through that.
Yeah, I've got the wheel of time back there, so I understand.
You understand, so yeah, you get it. Robert Jordan, yeah, dude. And like same with like the Song of Ice and Fire books, you know, whatever it may be. It's that time investment. It's obviously a financial investment. Costs more to read 9 books than it does 1. Then biggest one for me, honestly, is like the emotional investment. Like, I'm going to be with these characters for so long, and like, I just don't have the emotional wherewithal to like, I want to get in and get out with these characters. As much as I might love the characters in a single, you know, a standalone novel, like, I just want to, yeah, I want to read this and then move on to the next one and read more, you know.
Also, in kind of on that note too, it's actually an issue I do have with series. You know, like the Wheel of Time is a great example of it. You know, it's like what 14 books long, and they do have a couple of kind of shocking moments in it, but for the most part, you have this core cast of characters that once you're about 3 books in, you stop buying into the tension of the story. You know the main character is not going to die. Already know there's 8 books out or 10 books out. So obviously core characters are going to live, if not the whole time, most of the time. You know, maybe they'll pull a trick and kill off one. But, you know, one thing you know is like, okay, so there's like 9 core characters in Wheel of Time. You know they're not killing off 7 of them. You know, it's just not happening. And so, you know, there's a certain point where the situations just start to feel really artificial, really manufactured, and, you know, it's I lose some of the joy of reading at that point. Like Martin with the Song of Ice and Fire was pretty good with that because he was so brutal with killing off main characters. But
yeah,
even that started falling apart after a while. That's, you know, if there is going to be a coherent story, eventually it has to distill to certain surviving characters. And, you know, once you get past about book 3 of Song of Ice and Fire, it starts to stabilize. You know, you know, he introduces new points of view, but then inherently you care less about those new points of view than you did the ones you've been following since book 1. And so, yeah, you know, I think that there is an element of sustained storytelling where it really struggles to maintain a sense of stakes and tension after a certain point. And, you know, that leads to me to emotional disengagement with these characters. So like on the one hand, like I want to invest in them. I do enjoy reading about them, but it starts to feel more like fluff reading where, you know, you're just kind of cruising through pages. And not that that's bad either. Don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, there is something to be said for, kind of just chill, relax as you're reading.
Definitely.
But at the same time, you know, one of the things that does draw me to reading is that sort of the tension of not knowing what the outcome's going to be. You know, I like finding things that I haven't seen before. And so I struggle with engaging with these longer series. But I do think, you know, trilogies have the space to be able to work with a single arc while still maintaining a significant amount of variability and questions within that arc.
Yeah, no, I agree with that for sure. A trilogy, you still can, you can keep that development going throughout, but it's once you get into like 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 books that you're just like, you know, it goes away, like you said. It's just then there gets that kind of fatigue almost. But Andrew, we are actually well over an hour at this point. If people want to find you, where can they do so? If they want to get your books, if they want to connect with you on social media.
Well, so for getting my books, honestly, it's, you know, you can order, they should all be through Ingram. So they're all on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. I think you can even order freaking walmart.com if I remember right, which is both like interesting and creepy. but no, you know, really Amazon's the easiest way. They're on, I mean, you can get a print ebook or Kindle Unlimited. You know, I am, I do like telling people I have a limited edition indie horror brawl cover for Gala Talk, which I'm pretty happy about. Actually, I'll just get it right here.
Yeah, man.
It's, I like the original cover, but this is also, I think, equally good. It's, I'm excited about it for different reasons. This captures sort of that East Soviet bloc feel that that the book has. Whereas the original, I think, captures sort of the creepy dread and horror of it. So, you know, both are doing really cool things for it. But no, also Gala Talk and Mobius Store on audiobook as well. And then on social media, I'm most active on Facebook, largely, honestly, because of Books of Horror. It's just such a lively group. But I actually find there's a little more steady engagement on Facebook than there are on some of the other platforms. And I think people have longer conversations on Facebook, it seems. But I am on Instagram. I'm on Twitter. I'm on Blue Sky. I'm on Threads. I've got a TikTok account. And fortunately, because I have a weird ass last name, it's really easy to find me because there just aren't a whole lot of Andrew Nybergs operating out there. And so, you know, if you find an Andrew Nyberg, there's actually really good odds it's me.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate it. And I, like I said with Todd Kiesling, I wish you luck in the brawl, but not too much luck.
No, thanks for having me. And, you know, honestly, I will say I'm just happy to have made it into the brawl. You know, there's so many amazing books in there. And just to be sort of on those lists with them, it's just like, man, that's a great feeling.
It really is, right? Like, it's mind blowing. I had, like, there's authors that I look up to that are in that I like. I'm like, holy crap, I'm up against them. Like, it's wild. But yeah, man, I will definitely talk to you soon, and we're going to have to do this again sometime.
Absolutely. Anytime.
Awesome. Take care, buddy.
You too.